Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Everyone talking about the home finance train wreck and the U.S. economy this week, and the gunfire blazing in Iraq on the economy. John McCain went for the hard line.
It's not the duty of government to bail out and reward those who act irresponsibly, whether they're big banks or small borrowers.
Barack Obama said share the relief to fix the economy.
While this is consistent with Senator McCain's determination to run for George Bush's third term, it won't help families that are suffering, and it won't help lift our economy out of recession.
Hillary Clinton, if bankers get help, so should homeowners.
If the Fed can extend $30 billion to help Bear Stearns address their financial crisis, the federal government should provide at least that much emergency assistance to help families and communities address theirs.
And the soundtrack that mattered from Iraq and oil-rich Basra was all gunfire. Joining me today from Philadelphia is Trudy Rubin, foreign affairs columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Trudy, welcome back. Great to have you.
Hi, Tom. Good to be here.
With us from New York, Michael Mandel, chief economist for Businessweek magazine and author of the soon-to-be-released book, Essentials of Economics. Mike, great to have you with us as well.
Glad to be here, Tom.
Also with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, On Point news analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Trudy, and Michael.
We've got so much to look at. Trudy Rubin, let me come first to you. And what's going on in Iraq? President Bush says this is great. The Iraqi government stepping up to do the necessary. We should all feel heartened. How do you see it, Trudy?
Well, my sources in Baghdad, who are pretty high up, tell me that this came as a surprise to the Americans. There was not consultation in advance. And the way we should see this is an incredible risk that fighting is going to erupt between U.S. and Shiites. One of the main factors that has been the cause of the decrease in violence in recent months is that Muqtada al-Sadr, the radical cleric with the Mahdi militia, had declared a ceasefire. Now Maliki has started this fighting in the south, which is basically intra-Shiite fighting, to wipe out the Mahdi militia. And it's liable to reverberate back in Baghdad, already is beginning to. We may have to rescue him. The ceasefire may break down, and violence may erupt even worse in Baghdad. So this is a real mess, an unexpected one, just before Petraeus and Ambassador Crocker come back to testify before Congress.
You say a surprise to the Americans, though President Bush certainly didn't depict it that way. Here's a clip from the president in Ohio on Thursday saying this is a great sign.
Iraqi security forces are waging a tough battle against militia fighters and criminals in Basra, many of whom have received arms and training and funding from Iran. Prime Minister Maliki's bold decision, and it was a bold decision, to go after the illegal groups in Basra shows his leadership and his commitment to enforce the law in an even-handed manner. It also shows the progress the Iraqi security forces have made during the surge.
Jack Beatty, a bold decision or a surprise in the American lap? You heard the news headlines today. Americans now supporting Maliki's central government troops with Apache helicopter fire in Sadr City, called in for air support there, U.S. troops on the ground. Bold move, surprise, unwelcome to the Americans. How do you see it, Jack?
It has to be unwelcome. You know, President yesterday also said that Iraq was, quote, returning to normalcy. This one, Basra, is the scene of heavy fighting. And when across Iraq, McClatchy documents 50 incidents of civil war and anti-coalition violence on one day, yesterday, when Bush was proclaiming normalcy. You know, as we heard, he also charged that Sadr's militia has received training and funding from Iran. But Maliki's militia, the Badr organization, was created in Iran and paid for by Iran's Revolutionary Guard. That's the side he wants to win. Finally, in his litany of self-deception, he claimed that the surge has, quote, opened the doors to strategic victory. Well, as we heard from Trudy, the surge was premised, much of it, the benefit of it, on the ceasefire of Sadr. And now that may be out the window. The door is open, all right, not to Bush's strategic victory, but possibly to full-scale civil war.
Michael Mandel, there's so much on the economy. We're going to come to it in just a moment. But Trudy, take us back in here for another swing at this. We heard so much about Shiite versus Sunni tension and fighting for a long time until the Sunni awakening kind of brought that gang out of the al-Qaeda camp for a while anyway, or part of it. What is embedded in this Shiite struggle? The Shiites, you know, are back in power with Saddam out. So right. What's the basic conflict, and is it one that could sort of blow up the whole game board here?
I think there is a risk that it can. What the Americans had been hoping was this. Muqtada al-Sadr seemed to have decided to go into the political game full bore. He had declared a ceasefire with his Mahdi army, and he'd been carrying on a sort of mafioso clean-up-the-shop war within his militia because there were a lot of thugs who didn't want to stop fighting, and literally his people had been killing them off or beating them up. And the Americans had hoped, okay, Muqtada is going the political route. There are provincial elections scheduled for the fall. And it was expected that Muqtada's group was going to do very well in the southern provinces. The party that is in power in those southern provinces is the largest Shiite party, whose acronym is ISKI. And ISKI's militia is the Badr Corps. They are allied with the prime minister. Mm. So some people think that this was an effort to preempt an election victory by Muqtada's forces in the south. Now, no one or few in Iraq's middle class would weep if Muqtada's militia was cut down to size, although a large group of working class people and poor people would be very angry. But the Iraqi forces of the prime minister do not have the heft to do this. And Muqtada's people are dug in Basra, which was a lawless place in which militias fought each other, Shiite militias. So the prime minister, yes, is trying to restore order, but he's trying to do it for the benefit of his political backers to preempt election victory by Sadr's forces. And the problem is he probably will be pushed back. And the question is whether the Americans will have to come to his aid, and Muqtada al-Sadr will then scrap the ceasefire that has enabled Baghdad to become more peaceful. If that ceasefire is scrapped, you're liable also to see a renewal of sectarian fighting in Baghdad.
So we've got Shia Sunni. Who knows what comes out of this? John McCain with his big foreign policy speech this week saying now whatever's going on is not the time for the U.S. to pull out of Iraq.
It would be an unconscionable act of betrayal, a stain on our character as a great nation, if we were to walk away from the Iraqi people.
Michael Mandel, you've got maybe bigger fish to fry right in front of us here on the domestic front, but just for a moment, as a guy who watches the economy and the report of one of Iraq's big oil pipelines blowing up in the south this week, does this matter to the economy, to the world economy?
Does what's going on in Iraq matter
yes,
to the
sir.
World economy? Not right at this point. I think that it's important over the long run. It's probably keeping oil prices up a bit. But this is, from an economic point of view, these are not especially significant events. It sounds funny because they're significant in so many political and military ways, but in terms of the course of the U.S. economy and the world economy, it's not that important.
We've got two big dances going on here at once then. The war with all its implications, the economy with all the housing and finance problems behind it. What did you see emerging in all the speeches that rolled out this week, Michael Mandel? Clinton, McCain, Obama, all making big statements on where we are with the economy and where we ought to go.
That's right. What's happening now is that the presidential candidates are choosing up sides, with McCain on one side and Obama and Clinton on the other. McCain's speech was very clearly following the George Bush mold, which is less regulation rather than more. Not saying we're going to pump a lot of money into the housing market, and really kind of a hands-off attitude. On the other hand, the two Democratic candidates were saying very much similar things: more tight regulation, and at some point you have to put an infusion of money into the housing system to make sure that we get out of this in one piece.
And yet, there's already a big government intervention going on at several levels. Michael Mandel, is this a question of, you know, who ultimately gets the most help, or who gets help at all as everybody looks out on this suddenly kind of floundering economy?
Well, you have to break this up into two pieces. One is what the Fed has been doing is really a holding action. Think about the economy was about to go off the cliff and the financial markets were about to go off the cliff. And what the Fed has done is it sort of pushed it back. It's holding it back from the edge. The Fed can do that, but it can't actually solve the problem. It doesn't have the resources. It isn't set up for it. What I think you're going to sort of see after the presidential election, not before, is that there's going to have to be an infusion of capital into the economy, either to buy up bad loans or to help out the investors. And it's going to be a very big political fight over who's going to be helped and who's going to be left out to dry a bit. Since it's political rather than economic, it can't happen until after the election.
Is it a choice between bailing out banks and bankers and bailing out homeowners? Is that what it boils down to in economic or political terms?
Oh, and how much the taxpayers are going to be at risk. You think about this, there's homeowners, there's investors, there's the taxpayers. There's a big chunk of losses out there. Could be $1 trillion in losses, might be less, might be more. Somebody's got to bear them. And it's a political choice about who's going to take the brunt of it.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about a week in the news. We've got Trudy Rubin with us from the Philadelphia Inquirer today. Michael Mandel is with us, chief economist at Businessweek magazine. Jack Beatty's here as well. Also got a lot more tape to hear, but let's go first to Chris in Galilee, Rhode Island. Chris, you're on the air.
Hi, sir. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
And my name is actually it's Christopher Young, and I'm running for the United States Senate in Rhode Island. The reality here is that what's happened is that the repeal of the Glass-Steagall Act, which occurred in 1999, has had the largest effect on home foreclosures. There was what was called the Merchant Eight. Senators, congressmen who took the largest amounts of money from banks between 1995 and 2000. And Jack Reed was one of those congressmen. And they repealed Glass-Steagall Jack Reed voted to repeal Glass-Steagall in 1999. That has caused the destabilization of the mortgage market, the bond insurance market for local municipalities and states to fund their governments, and also the collapse of the United States dollar.
So where are you going with that, Christopher? You want more regulation, re-regulation, and should if there's a bailout, should it go to the banks or should it go to the homeowners who got caught in that vice?
We need to reinstitute the Glass-Steagall Act. We also need to reinstitute bankruptcy protections for homeowners, credit card holders, student loan debt. There's a credit worthiness crisis in our country. These presidential candidates are all related. They're all members of the Council on Foreign Relations, a globalist organization. This is really a monarchy, not a democracy. On my website, wheretovote.com, that's W-H-E-R-E-T-O-V-O.
Yeah, we hear it, and we've got the line of attack. Michael Mandel, there is a lot of talk this week about regulation and the lack thereof on banks and investment banks in particular that grabbed on to this subprime financing and sort of went off the cliff with it. Do you see that coming? Do you see one candidate more likely than another? John McCain got kind of more of the same policy here as his opponents suggest.
I think in the end we're going to see some tightening of regulations on the financial institutions. But what's fascinating, of course, is that these banks have themselves lost an enormous amount of money. So from my point of view, they're less guilty of mendacity and more guilty of being stupid. And the regulation, actually, Glass-Steagall was put in place to stop banks from being stupid. I don't think we're going to go back to Glass-Steagall, but we are going to go back to sort of tighter regulation on the investment banks and on the regular banks, too, to sort of make sure so that the government actually knows how much debt these guys actually have on their books. So we're going to see some more regulation. I don't think we're going to see an enormous tightening.
We had John McCain saying this week, it is not the duty of government to bail out and reward those who act irresponsibly. But, Jack, what about keeping some guardrails on the way people act?
Oh, indeed. You know, that speech of McCain's on the subprime mortgage mess, it was Hooverian, if not Marie Antoinette.
As in Herbert Hoover.
Yes, in its indifference to the plight of people who are losing their purchase on the American dream. But you know, it's really not atypical. John McCain will present the spectacle of a presidential candidate running in Iowa against the ethanol subsidy, running in Ohio against changing NAFTA, running in Florida against federal help for straitened homeowners, and running everywhere as John McSame on the war. And John McSame Bush on the economy. A study from the Center for American Progress this week finds five characteristics that his economic plan shares with Bush. Expensive, $2 trillion over the next decade. Disproportionately benefits the top 1%. 31% of the Bush tax cut went to them. 58% of the McCain will. The McCain plan shifts the burden, as Bush's plan did, from investment onto earned income. It doesn't address tax shelters, in fact, may increase them, and it's unlikely to be able to be paid for, this massive $2 trillion tax cut, without cutting Social Security, Medicare, or other key programs.
That's a long list. Let's hear from the candidates directly. Here's McCain in that speech saying he thought the government should have just a limited role in addressing economic crisis.
Government assistance to the banking system should be based on solely preventing systemic risk that would endanger the entire financial system and the economy.
Okay, Michael Mandel, is that Hooverian? Is that shades of Herbert Hoover? Or we read David Wessel in the Wall Street Journal this week saying, you know, the headline is 10 days that changed capitalism. The U.S. government has
disregarded. I thought that was a ridiculous headline. Look, what's happened historically in the U.S. economy, and this happened in 2000 and 2001 too, you have a boom, you have a bust. We go in and we sort of do some fixes to the system that sort of address what needs to be fixed at that point. And that's what's going to happen. And that's what's going to happen this time, too. We're going to go in response to this. And there's going to be tighter regulations for sure. It's not going to be looser. And there's going to be fixes on the things that went wrong this time. But the fact is that kind of back and forth is really what's characterized the U.S. economy over the last 20, 25 years. The one difference between the presidential candidates, I think, is the size and the speed of the infusion of money into the system. And I think it would be faster under the Democrats and slower under McCain simply because, that's where they're coming from. You know, I do have to say, though, George Bush's speeches about this did strike me not necessarily as Hooverian, but just not quite grasping the magnitude of this. Tom, let me just add one more thing here. Mm-hmm. I actually think 6 months from now, we're not going to be talking about the housing crisis anymore. We're going to be talking about the consumer spending and the consumer borrowing crisis, because I think this is actually going to – the housing crisis is a manifestation of something much larger, which is – Americans have a lot of debt. They have a lot more debt than they've ever had in the past. And what we're seeing, and we see this today, the government announced a slump in consumer spending for February, that this is going to continue. And the longer it continues, the more this is going to become the focus of attention.
Individuals battening down the hatches. Trudy, I want to come to you, but let us just hear for a moment first from the other two talking this week, Hillary Clinton, Barack Obama. Here's Clinton first responding to McCain going after him on the economy.
He recently admitted, "The issue of economics is not something I've understood as well as I should." And it turns out he'd rather ignore the credit crisis and the mortgage crisis or blame middle-class families instead of offering solutions on their behalf. I think we've had enough of a president who didn't know enough about economics.
And then speaking yesterday in New York, here's Senator Barack Obama laying out his agenda for addressing the country's financial crisis.
It's an agenda that starts with providing a stimulus that will reach the most vulnerable Americans, including immediate relief to areas hardest hit by the housing crisis, and a significant extension of unemployment insurance for those who are out of work. If we can extend a hand to banks on Wall Street when they get into trouble, we can extend a hand to Americans who are struggling, often through no fault of their own.
Trudy Rubin, Trudy, the whole world is watching here, and many economies doing their own kind of shaking in the last weeks as the U.S. political conversation plays out around this. What do you see, Trudy?
Well, I think the thing that has struck me between the eyeballs on this financial crisis is the subject of these debt instruments, these packaged mortgages that are then monetized and sold as debt instruments that back up further loans. And what struck me is how many leading financial figures have admitted that they don't understand how these debt instruments work, that they had no idea that many banks and hedge funds and investment banks were so dependent on them. It seems to me there's this rot in the system, which is new complex instruments that back up mortgages. I had a mortgage recently, took one out from a nice local mortgage company, and before I knew, it was taken over by somebody else, and you're not dealing with your friendly banker anymore. So the system is becoming so complex that nobody knows amongst the financial institutions what they really own anymore. And that's what's scary to me, because it creates a lack of confidence in the whole system, since nobody knows whether these packaged debt instruments they've got are rotten to the hilt and are going to explode on them. And I can't help but wonder if that's going to ripple through the world at a much greater level than we see now. And the other thing that worries me is the falling dollar, because, you know, I wonder how long it will be before they denominate oil in euros, and it is undercutting our reputation and also our purchasing power.
We've got listeners on exactly this front. Chuck is calling from Sherburne, Massachusetts. Chuck, what do you say?
Yes, on this matter of stupidity of the investment banks, I'm not sure that's what's going on. We have these investment vehicles, which I've heard only barely mentioned, that that one of the basic assumptions is that housing values have never gone down in the past 50 years.
Or at least never gone down all across the nation for a long time. Yeah,
all across the nation, right. And you look at the graphs, and it's clearly, you know, there's been many where the housing values have gone down. Now, how I cannot believe that people in the investment community would be that stupid to accept that kind of thing unless it was massive fraud. And I think there's prosecution that ought to be talked about here.
Never mind re-regulation. You want to really wrap some knuckles. Michael Mandel, what about it? John McCain says, we heard him right at the beginning, it's not the duty of government to bail out or reward those who act irresponsibly, whether big banks or small borrowers. But the Fed has already come in with relief on the investment bank front, not just Bear Stearns either, but more broadly with the open discount window.
Well, the Bear Stearns one is the one that really counts, because the Bear Stearns one is where the Fed actually put up real money as opposed to just lending money. I think if you go back to Herbert Hoover and the Great Depression, the mistake that was made then was not to do something, and especially the Fed stood by and didn't do what it should have done back then to make sure the economy didn't fail. So Ben Bernanke, the head of the Fed, remembers his history. He knows it very well. Mm. So you should think of this as him doing whatever he can right now to make sure the financial markets don't break. So he's doing what he should be doing. Now, you sort of asked the question, what should the rest of the government be doing? And there's a very fair question about how much money should go in and who should get it? Should it go to the homeowners? Should it go to the investment banks? Who should take the hit? And you see, it's interesting. The previous caller sort of talked about fraud. I'm sure there was a lot of fraud out there. But when I look at the amount of money that the investment banks have lost, what happens is I say these guys, well, were dumb. All right, yeah, they were just dumb.
And irrational exuberance.
And I really think Chuck's point was well answered by John Kenneth Galbraith in one of his books on the Great Crash. He wrote, "Speculation buys out the available intelligence." That's what happens. You know, greed overwhelms the intelligence.
Greed overwhelms the intelligence. But, you know, you have to realize at this point is that part of the reason why mortgages have gone down so much, mortgage rates have gone down so much over the last 10 years or the last 15 years, have to do with all these new financial instruments. And so what's going to happen in the end is that people are not going to want to give up on them. They're just going to want more transparency. And the transparency will sort of help both the markets and also will sort of help homeowners as well. Part of the consequences, though, is that rates will not be quite as low as they were in the past.
Of course, we had speculation going on at all kinds of levels, though, not just at the banking level. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Let's go to Jim in Providence, Rhode Island. Jim, you're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
I wanted to make a comment. I'm tired of hearing everyone talk about
a housing crisis. I think a housing crisis is when you lose your home and you're living out on the street. That's a crisis. But for these people who are going to lose their homes, they're obviously in a home they can't afford. They can easily move into an apartment that's going to be much more affordable. Where's the crisis? They want to make it sound as if it's such a bad thing that they're going to lose their home. Maybe it's the best thing that can ever happen to them because maybe they're in a home that they shouldn't have bought to begin with. And I'll take my answer off the air.
Okay. I mean, but you know, when you've got block after block with foreclosure going on and whole neighborhoods and whole communities falling apart, that's pretty tough, not to mention the individual pain. But what about it, Michael Mandel? Is this just a house cleaning? The bankers made a lot of money. Now they're losing some money. Should we just take it as a... you know, as a cyclical pain of capitalism that's natural and we all accept when those folks lose their homes?
Tom, that's obviously not true. I think that this what we mean by calling this a crisis is that if it was allowed to proceed unchecked at this point, it would have a lot bigger ramifications for the economy. The caller does have a point, which is that if you're someone who couldn't afford the home, then in fact you can't afford the home, and either there has to be government action to write down the size of the mortgage, which is to help the homeowner, or there's government action to sort of help move this person into another home. So somewhere along the way, there has to be some government intervention to sort of to get us through this. It is true, we built a lot of homes. People are going to be living in a lot of homes. The question is, how do we get through the next couple of years? I actually want to add something else here. Part of the reason why we had this crisis was because incomes didn't keep up with home prices. And part of the way that I think about this is that the debt outran the income. So you can think of this as that for a lot of Americans, their real wages actually fell over the last 5 years. And that's what underlies a lot of the pain here. We're working off an era which was about taking on a lot of debt and spending, and the income wasn't there. And so we're writing down the value of the U.S. economy at this point, and the question is it going to be smooth or cataclysmic?
And who feels the pain? Jack Beattie, how do you think this plays out politically? John McCain stands up in the middle of all that and says, in our culture, people take responsibility, and we can't go out and bail everybody out here. Now, you could say, meanwhile, Obama and Clinton are talking about $10 or $30 billion to ease the pain for individual homeowners. Which is more persuasive politically, do you think, Jack?
Well, you'd have to say, I don't know. I mean, I would guess that there isn't much stock in barren, eat-your-spinach individualism in a recessionary economy. That really does not seem to be very likely, does it? Who knows? You know, I'm disturbed that when you look at McCain's economic advisors, among them is Arthur Laffer, the developer of with Dick Cheney, by the way, of the Laffer curve, which you know, of supply side economics, which is a discredited theory and which he seems to have embraced whole hog, and much to the dismay of some people, in an ideological way. That is to say, he seems to be fixated on these ideological statements, can't intervene, people have to stand on their own, and not the practical needs of the day.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Tears, uneasy laughter, and a season opener overseas this week in Tibet's capital, Lhasa. A Chinese government press tour meant to showcase peace and calm was disrupted by some very unhappy Tibetan monks. Major League Baseball opened its season on the other side of the globe in Tokyo, where the Oakland A's and the Boston Red Sox took the field. Coco Crisp. And funny man Jay Leno wasn't so sure about President Bush's confident view of the U.S. economy.
President Bush said the economy is going through a rough patch, but he's confident things will work out, unless you own a home, own a car, have stock, or you're over 65. Other than that,
be fantastic.
In the above, we're looking at a week in the news, the fighting in Iraq, everybody on the economy this week and more. Trudy Rubin is with us from the Philadelphia Inquirer. Michael Mandel, chief economist at Business Week magazine. Look for his new book coming out, Essentials of Economics. Jack Beatty's here. Hillary Clinton speaking on the Bosnia business in a radio interview in Pittsburgh on Tuesday. Hillary Clinton said she misspoke about landing under fire in Bosnia in a March 17 speech. This is courtesy of KDKA News Radio.
I have written about this and described it in many different settings, and I did misspeak the other day. You know, this has been a very long campaign. Occasionally, you know, I am a human being like everybody else.
Chelsea Clinton out on the trail also this week at a college students forum at Butler University in Indiana. She was asked by an audience member about whether the Lewinsky scandal had hurt her mother.
Wow, you're the first person actually that's ever asked me that question. In the, I don't know, maybe 70 college campuses that I've now been to. And I do not think that's any of your business.
Smackdown from Chelsea Clinton there. Trudy Rubin, let's go to the Bosnia business. And Hillary Clinton, it wasn't a single instance in which she mentioned the sniper fire that she had landed under in Bosnia. You knew something about that arena. What do you make of these comments? Is this, you know, memory burnishing something into something it wasn't? How do you explain it, Trudy?
Well, you know, I landed in Bosnia during those years in UN planes. You are warned to look out for sniper fire. You are wearing a flak jacket. When I flew in, a lot of us were sitting on our flak jackets because we were told that fire could come up from below.
Yeah, the old sit on your helmet trick.
Planes. Yep. Right, exactly. You know, on the other hand, I think she wrote about this as well. You could say memory plays tricks. It was a mistake. I don't think it's the most important thing in this campaign. I do think it's a mistake to dwell on episodes like this as proof of anything. She shouldn't do it. But I don't think it's big enough for a political judgment that she's lying on her experience.
And yet, Jack, experience has been a great big card in Hillary Clinton's hand.
Yeah, and piece by piece, people have, well, questioned it. The Northern Ireland people have said, well, you know, she met at a pub with some women. She did make a speech in Beijing. The Macedonia situation, no, we really had taken care of the refugee problem before she got there. So piece by piece, this experience card has been wilted. You know, I mean, I think Clinton supporters have to face what the Politico wrote last week in a very careful analysis of the numbers. Quote, Hillary Clinton has virtually no chance of winning. She possesses, as David Brooks nicely put it this week, the audacity of hopelessness. She's not, you know, her only, if you look at the numbers, it's just not there. I would urge anybody to just take a look at the Politico story. And only a miracle from, you know, that is, if she were to win 60% of all the delegates remaining, and if she were to also win 60% of the delegates in Florida and Michigan, she could then prevail in delegates. But that's not going to happen. Florida and Michigan are off the table. Her only hope now, as everyone is saying, is to pummel Obama and to make him unacceptable. And there's some evidence that might well work. But then, so you have to wonder which presidency is she running for? That in 2008 or that in 2012?
In other words, accepting a McCain victory, and she comes back in her 60s then. Of course, John McCain's 71 now.
Right, but here you have, you know, 30% of her supporters say they will go with McCain in the general election. That's a pretty serious defection.
That's a problem, a cloud over the Obama climate or weather. Here's Hillary Clinton with reporters on Wednesday in Pennsylvania saying she doesn't feel pressured to drop out of the race, but is aware of calls out there for it. A number of newspaper editors this week noted her increasingly slim chances for a numerical victory.
I hear it in the atmosphere, but the most common thing that people say to me, it happened here, it happened last night, it happens everywhere now, is don't give up, keep going, we're with you. And I feel really good about that because that's what I intend to do.
Michael Mandel, look over from the economics throne you sit on there at politics. What do you see in the Democrats' race at this point?
I'm not a political expert, you know, but I was sitting with the McCain's economic advisor back in I don't remember exactly when it, whatever it was, then people were sort of writing off McCain completely. And they were saying that there was no chance that McCain was going to win the Republican nomination. Mm. And you know, the fact is, it is not the place of journalists. It's not the place of journalists to tell candidates to get out of the race. It just isn't. It seems to me that that journalists at this point sort of have had all sorts of opinions about who should do what. And Hillary Clinton has enough support that if she wants to keep going, she can. And, you know, I think that this race is almost certainly to be won by a Democrat. It's very, very hard for me to see how, given the state of the economy, that McCain is going to win. And, you know, frankly, I don't think it's the place of journalists to sort of say what the candidate should or shouldn't be doing.
Of course, editorial writers have a little different role, but I guess what people are trying to track here is what does it mean for the two parties as we go
forward?
No,
but, you know, the thing is that's not what people are saying. What people are doing is they're doing vote counting, and they're sort of saying that she should do this. Let me actually – can I come back to the question of what the candidates are saying, though, about the economy?
Please.
Because this is something I actually know something about. All right. They're talking about $30 billion plans at this point on the Democratic side. The fact of the matter is that if you look at the numbers, the real number is going to turn out to be $100 billion or $200 billion or even larger.
And that is the number, what, of individual homeowners, potential?
No, this is the number that the government bailout package is going to eventually have to be. $30 billion is completely insignificant given the size of the economy.
But let's dissect that bailout package. Are you including there the money already put up for Bear Stearns? Are you including what might be?
The Bear Stearns money is $30 billion, and that's pretty insignificant, too. This is the money that at some point the Congress and whoever the next president is going to have to put into the system to sort of make the economy move forward. It's going to be of a scale that the Democrats cannot talk about at this point and still remain electable. So people should know that the size of the package that we're talking about is actually going to be on the order of $100 billion, $200 billion. I sound a little bit like McCain, 100 years, you know. What?
Are you saying whether or not it's a Republican or a Democrat, whoever it is, it's going to end up?
Well, the Republicans will drag their feet on it, but the Democrats, especially if there's a Democratic Congress, will not. It will end up being something substantial enough to make a difference. And then you're sort of talking about three figures. You're talking about a medium three figures. Could you be talking about $250 billion? You could. Could you be talking about $350 billion? Conceivably. And that's the amount of money that's going to be necessary to move the economy kind of forward, or else this is going to go on for a long time. It's going to be, you know, it's interesting, you know, McCain talks about personal responsibility.
Yep.
In fact, he may just be a little bit early on this. The theme a year from now is going to be austerity, personal responsibility, savings.
Will the same theme be there, let me ask, for banks and the folks at the top of those banks? Let's go to
Sean. The answer is they're going to end up – you know, what happened to Bear Stearns is that it was sort of forcibly merged into J.P. Morgan, so
yep,
that a lot of people would be losing their jobs, and a lot of people who worked for Bear Stearns lost a lot of wealth. That's what's going to happen, is that if it's done right – anytime you actually step in to sort of save a bank, it will end up being merged in with a lot of losses for the shareholders.
Let's go to Sean in Providence, Rhode Island. Sean, you're on the air.
Hi. Thanks. Great show. One correction to what one of your guests mentioned. People often forget that the Federal Reserve did, in fact, inject massive, massive rate cuts and massive liquidity into the system very early on at the onset of the Depression, which was not caused by the stock market collapse. But I say I agree with many of your callers. Let's not be afraid of the free market. That's what bankruptcy is for. It's sure it's a hardship on the homeowners and the credit card holders, but they'll get a fresh start, a clean break, and a chance to start all over again. We need to cleanse this out of the market. Milton Friedman taught us that inflation is always and everywhere a monetary phenomenon. And I'm not interested in seeing a Weimar-style inflation in the U.S. or a dollar collapse such as occurred after the Plaza Accords. I want us to be capitalists on the way up and not socialists on the way down.
But what about, we've seen the CEO of Bear Stearns going away if it goes up to $10 a share or something like that, with some tens of millions after everything he's been paid. I mean, yeah, that's not the kind of fresh start you're going to have, you know, on some back street in a little town, Sean. That's a different story.
Yeah, except for the Fed got caught, and they're probably going to have to sacrifice a couple more of these investment banks before this is all over. And yeah, they got snookered by J.P. Morgan and Jimmy Dimon, but they won't get snookered the second or third investment bank that we have to take down. But lastly, you know, I would like to see some kind of question or inquiry into Secretary Hank Paulson and his role at Goldman Sachs, where he profited handsomely as an officer of all this. And
now he's helping design the bailout, or the relief anyway.
Yeah, I mean, you know, like a hooker working both sides of the street.
Whoa, okay.
But what do you say? What do you say about the counter-cyclical necessity of stimulating demand? I mean, if austerity has this moral appeal to you, what about the practical argument that to get an economy started, people have got to buy things? If they don't have the money, if they're strapped, if they're being forced out of their homes, they won't have the money.
That's what
we came to ultimately
in the Depression.
Here's what you have to realize is that people haven't had the money. They've been borrowing the money. That's the problem here. They ran up an extra $3 trillion in debt since 2000. It's actually unprecedented. You look at the charts, and it's straight up. And the problem here is, you know, there's an underlying problem here, and part of it has to do with our relationship to the world economy. Part of it has to do with productivity. The underlying growth hasn't been there, and many people who didn't have rising incomes were borrowing to maintain rising standards of living. Now, you could sort of say, whose fault was this?
And that debt was extended by somebody.
It was extended by somebody who thought that you could never go wrong lending to the U.S. consumer. And we're about to see a snapback on that with the banks and the credit card companies are going to pull back. They're going to stop lending so much, and you're going to see a contraction of people's living standards, and there's going to be screams all over the place, and it's going to feel incredibly painful. And frankly, this is why the Democrats are probably going to win in November, because by the time we get to there, by the time we've had 6 months of flat or falling consumer spending, for a lot of people, whether it's an official recession or not, it's going to feel like one.
Looks like a lot of pain coming. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Let's get a call from Jeff in Hartford, Connecticut. Jeff, you're on the air.
Hi, great show. Great show. I just want to say that I disagree with the last caller, and I want to echo what Trudy said earlier. When you have a financial system that's unregulated, it's not like this happened overnight. Everybody knew that this was like pigs feeding at the trough. Nobody was saying everything was going down the tubes. In fact, all the financial wizards 2 months ago were starting to say, yeah, it doesn't look good, but they just kept going.
It was still an open bar.
It's still an open bar. And now the American people have been shut off, but not the financial community, because the Federal Reserve, unbeknownst to anybody because they didn't make their decision public, are going to bail out the financial wizards again and Wall Street again, just like the people were bailed out during the savings and loan crisis, and then we take it on the chin again. I'm really sick and tired of 28 years of this conservative juggernaut that is going 200 miles an hour right into a stone wall. And we always get the people without significant stock portfolios and wealth are the ones to take it on the chin all the time.
Jeff, our time is short, but thank you for your call. Trudy Rubin, remind us of what Hillary Clinton mentioned this week, the Japan example. She said she's worried about this country, you know, getting into that kind of funk that its equivalent of the Fed, or ours, is simply incapable of solving on the economy front. It's just too big for the Fed to pull us out of, and we get a long bad stretch economically.
Well, in fact, in Japan, the government was very slow in taking action. They had a real estate crisis, a collapse, especially in Tokyo, and they had banks in big trouble. And the government there let it just play out, and they had 10 years of stagflation. And so the lesson that the Japanese are telling the Americans to learn is you've got to intervene more. You know, I have a feeling that all three of the candidates, whoever wins, is going to find that they have to do things after they win that may be different from what they said before. McCain should he win, would find out that more interventionism was necessary. And the Democrats, if they win, will probably find out they have to do something different on Iraq, because I think the lesson of what's going on now in Basra is that when there's no U.S. troops there, the British have pulled back to base, then you just have the Iraqis starting to fight amongst themselves because no institutions are strong enough to prevent that. So I think we're heading into a lot of uncharted territory and after this election.
You know, Trudy, one more thing. I can't leave those Tibetan monks just crying in Lhasa without some comment. We just got 10 seconds or 15 here, but China and Tibet, what's emerging from that?
China's big mistake is not talking to the Dalai Lama. He was not behind the violence. This was pent-up anger over discrimination against Tibetans in their own region, economic and political. The Chinese should be talking to him. They seem not to be going to do it. They're going to be embarrassed at the Olympics.
Trudy Rubens at the Philadelphia Inquirer. Trudy Rubin, Michael Mandel at Business Week magazine, Jack Beatty, our own On Point news analyst. Thanks to all of you for being with us today, and have a great weekend. What a view of the week. What a world. Listeners, you can continue the conversation and download the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Trudy, Michael, Jack, thanks. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.